Hi, I'm Marco Werman. Over the past several months, we have all experienced how an event in a corner of China has overwhelmed and reshaped our lives. As I speak, COVID-19 continues to spread through virtually every country on Earth. We began reporting on the coronavirus in January, and our content is freely available to everyone. None of our coverage has ever been behind a paywall. Global reporting is expensive to create, which is why we are asking for your support during this brief appeal. We're grateful when you listen to public radio, and especially grateful for supporting the journalism of the world in this moment. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute, or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Be safe, be healthy, and thank you. Seal off the borders. It's been widely used to combat the coronavirus. Some argue it doesn't work.
It's akin to saying you live in the castle and you pull up the drawbridge and you hope the virus can't swim across the moat.
In Singapore, the government wants everyone to give up some privacy and put a government app on their phones.
Their phone numbers are not exchanged. There's no geolocation data involved. And personal identifying data is not exchanged either.
That's not enough reassurance for some, though. And on the front lines, nurses and doctors risk their lives to fight the pandemic.
This is a special occupation, and we have to honor it. And we have to protect the safety of those who choose it.
That includes their mental health, too. Plus, a cyclist foiled in a virtual race. Do not unplug that stationary bike. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today on The World. President Trump has a new target, the World Health Organization. The president has been scapegoating the WHO's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, saying they called it wrong. Last night, the president again threatened to hold back American funding.
And I think they have to get their priorities right. And their priorities are that everybody has to be treated properly, every country. And it doesn't seem that way, does it? It doesn't seem that way.
The director of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, warned against politicizing the virus and the crisis.
We care for the poor. We care for those who are vulnerable. And we regret when we lose lives. That's where we should focus.
The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health and is following these developments. Ilana, to start with, beyond Trump, what are the roots of this criticism in how the WHO is handling the pandemic response and caving to pressures from China?
Yeah, Marco. So the big issue is when the WHO knew critical information from China and then when they mobilized the global community to respond. One of the things the WHO can do is declare an international emergency to sound the alarms and to kickstart a massive response. But the thing is, when you do that, it's a really tricky balancing act to get right. They faced criticism in the past for when they did this for Ebola in 2014 in West Africa. Ilona Kickbush is a founding director of the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute of International Studies in Geneva. She's also been an advisor to the WHO, and I asked her about this.
So in public health, and particularly in global health, it is such a difficult balancing act, you know, to say, when exactly do we cry wolf? Because if you cry wolf too often, too early, then you're going to be in deep trouble if countries do take consequences.
And so this question is, when and how did the WHO make those decisions this time?
So how did the WHO manage the response to coronavirus early on and figure out what was happening in China?
The answer to this, Marco, is nuanced because on the one hand, China was really quick to share the genetic sequence of the virus to the global community. And that was actually the result of a system of coordination for reporting that the WHO spent decades building up and creating something that countries do want to contribute to and share. But there were also huge problems. For example, initially, the reporting from China stressed that they weren't seeing human-to-human spread. And now there's more reports coming out, such as from U.S. intelligence, that lots was known earlier on than before the WHO stepped up and declared that emergency. Amish Adalja is a senior scholar at the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins, and here's what he had to say about it.
They were late to call a public health emergency of international concern. They were late to declare a pandemic. And there was some concern regarding how much of a pass they gave China for some of the draconian measures they put into place, including the restriction of free speech and the glowing review that they made of China after their team went there
But also, Marco, here's the thing. A lot of public health leaders, including Dr. Adalja, kind of could read between the lines and know that the WHO has to balance these political pressures. So many were already mobilized before that declaration and were trying to figure out what was going on with this new coronavirus.
So in what way is the WHO susceptible to political pressures?
It is run by how 94 member states vote on their priorities. These representatives, they decide the power of the WHO. Even as they go and give the WHO the power to declare emergencies, none of this is enforceable. In some ways, its power is how it plays its own political game and works behind the scenes.
The world's Alana Gordon on the Global Health Beat. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Almost half the world's population is under some type of self-quarantine right now. If that's what it takes to save lives, most people are on board. Of course, there are limits to what we'll tolerate. Singapore's government is intruding on its people in some, let's say, creative ways, including a new tactic they hope spreads across the globe. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen.
It's an app for your phone called Trace Together. And according to the Singaporean government, it's simple. You just download it and then...
get peace of mind for you and your family through community-driven contact tracing.
Okay, contact tracing. This has been Singapore's top weapon in fighting the new coronavirus. You get infected, officials will interrogate you, go through your phone, look at security camera footage, anything to figure out everyone you may have spread it to. And that takes a lot of time. But this app, it'll help speed things up, because every time you spend more than 30 minutes with someone, just hanging out within a 6-foot radius, it will know.
The more people on board Trace Together, the faster we can combat COVID-19. Trace Together, safer together.
Now, the way it works is Bluetooth signals from your phone ping other people's phones, and it records those pings. It only works if both people have the app. Now, potentially letting the government know everyone you hang out with? Well, in Singapore, there are a lot of people who seem fine with that.
There's this sense that, oh, this is an extraordinary situation, so we need to just follow what the government says and fall in line.
That's Kirsten Han, and she's been a little reluctant to fall in line. Han is an activist and journalist in Singapore, and she runs a newsletter called We the Citizens, which often looks at government overreach. She says her reluctance to download the app makes her a bit of an outlier. She says the rally around the flag vibes are pretty heavy now in Singapore.
There is that sort of sentiment that kind of reminded me of what a lot of Americans observed post 9/11, when it was impossible to question the government when it came to security, no matter what they did.
But the government says, look, people have bad memories. They're bad at recalling who they've hung out with. They need this app. Here is the Minister of Information, Janelle Puttacherry, in a recent address.
It means that poor memory will no longer slow down the process of contact tracing. It provides a logbook of those interactions.
He also says, we promise not to look at it unless you're at risk, like if your phone has been around someone who got the virus. And he says the data it collects isn't super revealing anyway.
Two people have the app installed. There's a Bluetooth handshake between their phones, but their phone numbers are not exchanged. There's no geolocation data involved, and personal identifying data is not exchanged either.
Also, at this point, no one is forcing people to use this app, which is why Han isn't necessarily super against it.
The government hasn't said it's mandatory, but there is, you know, a bit of social pressure to download it. What I'm more concerned with is, after the crisis is over, do these powers go away or do they stay?
The app only works in Singapore, a city-state with roughly 5 million people. So, should the rest of the world be concerned about Trace Together? Maybe, because Singapore wants to make its mark by sharing this technology with any government that wants it. And tech teams in Seattle and at MIT, they're already building similar apps. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
One approach that many countries, as well as cities like Wuhan, China, have taken to halt the spread of the virus, slamming shut the borders. Now some border restrictions are lifting. So are the lockdowns effective? I asked Lori Garrett, one of the world's foremost experts on infectious disease outbreaks. Her reporting on epidemics has won her the Polk, the Peabody, and the Pulitzer Prize.
there's no good correlation. In fact, there may even be a negative correlation between countries that took tough stances early in this epidemic to shut down plane flights, to create restrictions on travel and movement, the akin to closing a border. I mean, these days you don't close a border with a fence across a piece of geography. You close a border by eliminating air travel and train travel. We did it very early. Several countries that also did it early have had profound epidemics.
Yeah, give me an example of that negative correlation.
Well, it's not just one country. It's the whole darn world. And this is probably because many countries took that stance without doing other things. So there was a sort of hopeful assumption that, you know, I always say it's akin to saying you live in the castle and you pull up the drawbridge and you hope the virus can't swim across the moat. That is what essentially the airport closures and travel restrictions constituted. But the truth is the virus was already in total global circulation long before most countries started pulling up their drawbridges. And frankly, the drawbridge didn't work. So countries banked on the drawbridge and didn't take other tougher measures, such as building up testing capacity and executing widespread testing, as South Korea did, such as going through your inventory to figure out what you need to be ready. Do you have trained personnel? Do you have equipment? Do you have medical supplies? Are your hospitals ready? Ventilators, all these things. And instead of focusing on let's get ready and let's figure out how to spot the fires before they turn into full-fledged conflagrations and snuff them out at the small smoldering fire stage, the countries thought, well, you know, we kept it out because we pulled up the drawbridge and it didn't work.
How worried are you about Wuhan, China, slowly ending travel restrictions this week?
It may very well be the case that the majority of the population of Wuhan was exposed. And if there is immunity against COVID-19, exposure in Wuhan should have been extensive, and many, if not most of the population, should be immune to the virus. I think China's susceptibility and vulnerability is elsewhere, that other parts of the country will see, just by the nature of globalization, will see cases reintroduced, either travelers from overseas or Chinese that are traveling around within the country or out of the country and back again. And so it's inevitable that they will see reintroduction. It's just not likely to be Wuhan that gets slammed again. Maybe it'll be Guangzhou. Maybe it'll be Shenzhen. Maybe it will be way up in the northeast or far over on the coastal regions. It's not possible to predict precisely.
So closing borders, is it a lost cause?
I think so. Most countries economically suffer greatly by closing borders. And at best, it may buy you a few days. But if you don't use those days to prepare for the inevitable arrival of the virus and take the right steps, then it's squandered time.
So how much does public trust in its government count at a moment like this? And where have you seen it playing out for good?
There is nothing more elemental to public health and effective response in an emotional crisis than trust, a two-way trust, that the people must trust their government and the government must trust that the people will follow its advice and, you know, not require that you force people at gunpoint to do anything, but rather that you give sound advice and the public responds. And the countries that seem to have the best bonds of trust between the public and government and its health leaders are also showing the best responses. That would be South Korea, Singapore, Japan, Hong Kong, and the places with the worst relationship between public health, government, public health establishment and the public are showing just hideous responses. This is true, for example, it's no surprise that Italy had such a strong, horrible continuing response. And it has a lot to do with Italy not having any stable government for eons and a tremendous amount of distrust within the country against government, against vaccination, against science.
Science writer Laurie Garrett, thank you very much. Always good to speak.
Thank you.
This is The World. Hello, public media fans. We know you value what we do here at The World, but it costs a lot of money to bring you these important stories. Important stories with context and critical voices from the front lines in our interconnected world. That's why we are asking for your support during our spring campaign. These days, more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking you to help support it now. Go to theworld.org/give. Become a monthly supporter of the program that informs, educates, and connects you with our changing world. That's theworld.org/give. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. A climate activist uses her organizing skills to help communities through the pandemic. We're meeting her today in our climate change solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The organization is called Caremongering, you know, like scaremongering, but spreading care instead of fear. Valentina Harper, an indigenous community organizer, co-founded the group in Toronto in mid-March. The idea was to connect people who needed things like groceries, money, or medicine with people who could donate those things. Harper was expecting a couple dozen from one small community to join the Facebook group. 4 days later, it had 8,000 members.
It was glaringly obvious that people were desperate to connect to each other and to help each other, or desperate for help.
There are now caremongering Facebook groups in more than 30 countries, giving them more than 600,000 members. It's part of a trend of mutual aid groups popping up in response to the pandemic.
Mutual aid has been happening since time immemorial. You know, people have been taking care of each other for a very long time. It's how we've survived, especially marginalized communities, indigenous communities, people of color. It's all about taking care of each other when the government fails to do so.
Thousands of people have been helped by these mutual aid groups, from grocery drop-offs to free legal advice, even online yoga sessions. Before the pandemic, Valentina Harper focused her organizational skills on climate justice, protesting oil and gas development, protecting water from pollution, and advocating for indigenous land rights. She says the same groups most vulnerable to COVID-19 are also more likely to suffer from impacts of climate change.
Everything is very much related. It's going to be our poorest, our most marginalized, who will always pay the price.
Harper says she hopes the newly formed caremongering groups stay engaged after the pandemic ends to keep helping each other deal with the new coronavirus and environmental issues that impact their communities.
And leverage this people power that we've gotten to talk to our political leaders and say, what are you going to do about the things that are affecting our communities? How are they going to be taken care of?
Harper says working on this big mutual aid project has inspired her.
Personally, there's a glimmer of hope, and I have more hope for humanity now deep into this crisis than I did going into it.
Valentina Harper is an Indigenous community organizer in Toronto and co-founder of the Caremongering Mutual Aid Group. As part of our weekly segment about climate change that we call The Big Fix, we've been asking you for your questions. Our environment editor, Carolyn Beeler, is here with me to answer one of those questions. And Carolyn, that question is also related to the current pandemic.
That's right. We have a question from Dennis Mick, who listens to The World on KUT in Austin, Texas. He wrote to ask whether there's a connection between climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, and what's the answer?
It is too early to say whether there's any link between climate change and this current pandemic. We do know that there is a link between the environment and emerging zoonotic diseases, so new viruses that spill over, as we say, from animals into humans. So as we change the environment through climate change, shifting animal habitats, and through things like deforestation, we do increase the risk of animals moving from their traditional habitats into places where humans are. We also know that as we warm the earth, the habitat for mosquitoes that carry things like malaria and dengue fever are expanding. So we don't know if there's any link between climate change and this pandemic, but we do know that there is a link between the environment more broadly and this pandemic.
Yeah, what do we know so far about how environmental factors and the pandemic are linked?
Well, we've long known that air pollution, of course, has an impact on human health. If you live in an area where there's more pollution from things like car exhaust and power plants, you're more likely to have problems with your lungs, with your heart, have asthma. And new evidence that's actually emerging this week is showing that the link between air pollution and COVID-19 is actually pretty strong.
So what exactly are those links, Carolyn?
The first nationwide study done here in the U.S. looking at air pollution and the coronavirus pandemic has found that even a small increase in air pollution where you live increases the risk that if you get COVID-19, you will die from it. So we're talking the difference between if you live in a downtown area and the county right next door. The small difference in air pollution there leads to a 15% higher likelihood that you would die of COVID-19 if you acquire it. And that increase is magnified in communities with more Black and Hispanic residents.
And do we know yet if the impact we're seeing in early data here is also true globally?
This Harvard study that was released pre-peer review this week is the first of its kind. It hasn't been done elsewhere yet, but the researchers have released the underlying code of their research in the hopes that scientists in places like Italy and China would do the same type of research. It is important to note that the U.S. has, on average, low levels of this small particulate pollution that was looked at in this study. So if the same impact is also observed elsewhere in places with higher levels of pollution, in India, for example, other countries in Southeast Asia, in African countries, in the Middle East, this impact could have a pretty strong effect on mortality from COVID-19.
The World's Carolyn Beeler, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Marco.
And my friends, keep your questions about climate change solutions coming. Email us at climate@theworld.org. If you've been sharing a home office with your significant other, or you're still obsessing about that Peloton commercial, here's a story you might relate to. Marinda Carfrae is an Australian triathlete. Earlier this week, she was competing in a virtual bike race from her home in Boulder, Colorado.
Our three-time Ironman world champion, Australia's Marinda Carfrae, is in the upper left of my screen. She's racing against a nine-time Ironman 70.3 winner from South Africa, Jeannie Seymour. And there's two more. Didi, who have you got?
The race was a 90K. That's almost 60 miles. Carfrae was gunning along. She was about halfway through, in second place. But then, enter husband.
He kicked out the plug. Oh, what an idiot.
Carfrae's husband, Tim O'Donnell, had good intentions. He entered the room with a few of her trophies in hand, you know, to show them off to the camera and intimidate the competition, but in the process accidentally yanked out the plug to her bike.
Go!
In the moment, I actually didn't realize. I just was like, oh no, like, something's wrong. But a few minutes later, we realized, oh no, it was his silly big foot that that kicked out the cable. And yeah, it was quite funny. He was a little bit embarrassed and obviously very sorry. But, yeah, we've had a good laugh out of it since.
Carfrae says the experience taught her a valuable lesson about sharing a workspace.
Maybe just lock the door. Like, find your space and lock your spouse out.
But wait, there's more. Carfrae's husband is also a triathlete, and he has a virtual race this Sunday.
I certainly won't pull the plug out from his race, but I'll have to come up with some sort of sweet revenge for this Sunday for him.
Dude, keep your eyes on the road and the plug. News headlines are coming up next. You're with the world. Now more than ever, some of us just need a drink, even the non-drinkers.
I have been having one or two drinks. It helps for whatever reason kind of calm the nerves.
But some countries are banning alcohol sales during the coronavirus pandemic. That's leading to some frustration and reports of a rise in moonshine. That's still coming up here on The World. From China to Italy to the U.S., doctors and nurses are under enormous pressure, working in dangerous conditions, exposing themselves to a potentially deadly virus. On top of that, there's the mental health aspect of that pressure and burnout. Dr. Beth Laun is the chief medical officer at the Schwartz Center for Compassionate Healthcare in Boston. She's also an associate professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. So long and extended exposure to disease, long hours staying away from home, what kind of a mental toll are you noticing both here and in other countries that have already gone through the thick end of this pandemic?
Well, thank you for asking and thank you for being concerned. I think caregivers are facing enormous challenges right now. Of course, they're very fearful of exposing others, of bringing home the virus. I think that really dominates over their fear of becoming ill themselves. And because of that fear of exposure, many of them are actually separating themselves from loved ones, renting apartments and just surviving on FaceTime or other kinds of platforms. Of course, there's the physical and just the mental exhaustion from the work hours, but there are some other things as well. And there are just levels of grief and loss that I think have just never been witnessed before. The rapidity of the pace, it's very, very hard to deal with. And they can't escape. You know, one of the significant risks for PTSD is when you can't get to safety. It's really concerning me.
Well, I've read the sad news of two nurses taking their lives in Italy. I mean, we know that PTSD often materializes weeks, months, even years after the initial trauma. It is post-traumatic syndrome, after all. What could that look like when it emerges in some of these doctors and nurses?
I think we weren't adequately prepared for this pandemic. And what I'm concerned about is that there actually may be a second pandemic of mental and behavioral health issues, especially among healthcare professionals.
Can you explain a little bit more what that second wave of the pandemic, a mental health wave, is that what you're implying?
Yes, exactly right. I mean, acute stress symptoms start to appear immediately, along with anxiety, depression, stress reactions. But we don't really make a diagnosis of PTSD until 6 months or more of symptoms. So right now, I think what we're seeing, and we saw this in other pandemics as well, we're seeing anxiety, depression, you know, in the H1N1 pandemic, about a year after discharge among survivors of acute respiratory distress syndrome, over half had symptoms of anxiety. 28% had depression. 44% were at risk for PTSD. And being a healthcare worker was significantly associated with those outcomes. So I think we're wise to anticipate that soon.
Mm. What are some of the different methods being used to help medical professionals cope mentally with this crisis?
Typically, in most healthcare organizations in the U.S., those healthcare organizations have offered EAP, employee assistance programs, human resources, and so forth. But, you know, the culture of medicine is one that prizes strength and stoicism and stamina. So reaching out for help is really not something that's willingly done by most healthcare professionals. And we don't want to appear, quote, weak, either to ourselves or to others.
Yeah, so how worried are you, Dr. Lown, about what the enormous pressure of coronavirus on doctors and nurses will actually do to the whole field? Will this moment, do you think, deter future doctors and nurses?
I'm worried about that, Marco. That said, I don't want to be completely pessimistic. What we don't know is what new innovations and what new kinds of approaches to healthcare might look like in, you know, what will surely be a reconfigured healthcare landscape of the future. And we can instill that love of this vocation. This is not work. This is a calling. And I think that's why you're seeing so many people stepping up. You're seeing volunteers coming to New York City. This is a special occupation, and we have to honor it. And we have to protect the safety of those who choose it.
Dr. Beth Lown, the Chief Medical Officer at the Schwartz Center for Compassionate Healthcare in Boston. She's also an Associate Professor of Medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Keep turning to the world for your coverage in this extraordinary moment of the coronavirus outbreak. You can find more of our in-depth reporting on COVID-19 at theworld.org/coronavirus. That's theworld.org/coronavirus. This week, the Trump administration took an unprecedented step to fight terrorism. Nathan Sales is the State Department's counterterrorism coordinator.
This is the first time the United States has ever designated white supremacist terrorists, illustrating how seriously this administration takes the threat.
The move allows the Treasury Department to block property or assets held by a designated terrorist group. Americans are also barred from doing any financial transactions with them. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, the changes could open new paths to counter right-wing extremism in the U.S.
In January 2017, a refugee shelter in Gothenburg, Sweden, was bombed. No one was killed, but a janitor there was seriously injured. A week after the attack, Swedish investigators announced they had three suspects. The men were members of a neo-Nazi organization. Then came this detail that caught the attention of counter-terrorism experts.
Several of the members who conducted this attack had traveled to Russia to receive some form of paramilitary training.
John Lewis studies extremism at George Washington University. He says the camps in Russia were run by an ultra-nationalist group called the Russian Imperial Movement. It's also known as RIM. The group is based in Russia, but it has connections around the world, including here in the U.S.
Some reports allege that they were reaching out to some members who had been organizers of the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, and had maybe offered them the opportunity to travel out to Russia and kind of conduct similar paramilitary training.
Lewis says there is no evidence that anyone from the U.S. took up an offer for training in Russia. But officials at the State Department were concerned enough to designate RIM as a terrorist organization. Connor Micheladi, who has studied the group, says it's difficult to know exactly how many members it has. But he says one of its main goals is to topple the Russian government and replace it with a monarchy.
Now, to be a part of that group, you have to be a member of the Russian Orthodox Church. That's kind of the main qualifying factor there. Otherwise, you just have to be willing to go to their rallies, propagate their ideas.
The group is pretty obscure, says Alina Polyakova. She's at the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington. Polyakova says she was surprised by the news that the Trump administration decided to target this particular group. To her, this is more of a political move.
This administration has received quite a bit of criticism since the president's election that it was not tough enough on Russia, a country that, of course, interfered in the U.S. election, that has done other various misdeeds across the world, including Ukraine.
She says the idea here is to push back against the narrative that this administration is soft on Russia.
The second way this was a political move is, of course, the administration has been criticized quite a bit for not taking white supremacism, white nationalism, extremism very seriously in the United States. So I think this was also a way for them to say we do take it seriously.
Political or not, Christian Piccellini says this is a positive step.
It's partly a forward-looking play because the alliances that this group has to other organizations, to other groups, some of them very prominent in the United States, will allow them to eventually add other groups to this list as well.
Piccellini himself was recruited into a neo-Nazi group at the age of 14. He went on to become a leader of the group. He recorded hate music and performed abroad.
Since then, in the last 24 years of my life since leaving the movement, I have been working to help pull people out of hate movements.
In the past, Piccellini says, the label terrorist was almost always used just for Islamic extremist groups.
For so long, the focus for countering violent extremism or terrorism from administrations past and present has always been to focus on people that have brown skin. And all that time, there has been terrorism and extremism happening, you know, from extremists who have white skin. And I think it's about time that we started to recognize that this is a problem and start to put the resources towards it. And I'm glad to see some movement on that.
He says since the news of the terrorist designation spread, at least one white supremacist group based here in the U.S. has said it is disbanding. And as for the Russian Imperial Movement, social media companies are now busy scrubbing their material off their platforms. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Amazon has run out of its stock of the novel. The British publisher Penguin Classics says it's struggling to keep up with orders. I'm talking about a book written over 70 years ago, La Peste, The Plague, by French existentialist Albert Camus. It's back on the bestseller list.
The invalid was an old Spaniard with a hard, rugged face. Placed on the coverlet in front of him were two pots containing dried peas. When the doctor entered, the old man was sitting up, bending his neck back, gasping and wheezing in his efforts to recover his breath. His wife brought a bowl of water. "Well, doctor," he said, while the injection was being made, "they're coming out. Have you noticed?" "The rats, he means," his wife explained. "The man next door found three." "They're coming out. You can see them in all the trash cans." It's hunger.
That's an excerpt from an audiobook version of the novel. The plague is set in the Algerian city of Oran. The city is suddenly overwhelmed with dying rats. Then residents also start dying. Government officials are slow to take notice. Robert Zaretsky is a professor of history at Honors College at the University of Houston. Robert, Camus published The Plague in 1947, right after World War II. I kind of summed up what's going on in the novel. Is there more to say about the plot that we should take note of today in this age of coronavirus?
Well, there's so much more. First, as you noted, Marco, the book was published in 1947, but Camus started writing the book much earlier than that. As soon as he completed The Stranger, which was published under the German occupation in 1942, he started taking notes for The Plague. He begins drafting passages in 42, 43, and it's at that very same moment that he joins the resistance. But it's much bigger than about the Nazi occupation and the French response, the response of the resistance to that occupation. It's also about the shadow of communism, which by then, of course, was looming across Europe. And Camus was terrified by communism. And so he sees communism, totalitarianism, as no better than the Nazism that France had just liberated itself from. But as far as I can tell from the response of the students that I teach who have read The Plague, it clearly has great resonance for them today.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, with these overlying themes of resistance in France during the war and the fight against communism that Camus kind of saw as really important, why is The Plague now flying off the shelves? I mean, if readers are hoping for some lesson about the present-day coronavirus, will they be disappointed?
No, they won't be disappointed. I think all the lessons that are there. I mean, I don't want to become too political, but among the prescriptions, among elements of the cure to what the characters in the novel confront are the very things that we confront, for example, in our country. Namely, we have political authorities who are in deep denial about the crisis that our countries face today. Not only are they in deep denial, but their use of language is meant not to communicate, but to miscommunicate. This is something that two of the most important characters in The Plague remark upon time and again, that they want the authorities to speak in a clear and concise fashion. Mm. They want them to speak truth, and they're not getting truth from them. Words are being used to disguise rather than reveal. So yes, in that respect, along with many others, The Plague is unhappily all too relevant for us today.
Have you reread The Plague lately, and how does it hold up?
I reread it 3 weeks ago. I'm teaching it in my nihilism class. And it's frightening how well it holds up. And I can actually give you the addresses to 19 students in my seminar who I think believe the very same thing.
Probably won't want to do that on air. We'll save that for another time. Robert Zaretsky is a professor of history at Honors College, University of Houston. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure being with you.
Tomorrow on The World, we'll be spending the hour on some big questions many of us are wrestling with right now. Reconciling widespread illness and suffering through faith. Or is it something else that brings you comfort? Reflection and connection tomorrow on The World. I need a drink. I often say that on a Friday. Now I'm starting to say it a little earlier in the week. If you're feeling the same way, I get it. We all get it. In parts of Mexico, a little tipple is no longer possible. Governors throughout the country have limited and in some cases outright banned the sale of alcohol. Here's Emily Green.
Jose Escamilla lives in Tabasco, in southern Mexico. It's hot outside, 97 degrees.
Con estos calores, pues, normalmente la gente sí toma mucha cerveza.
With this heat, people here usually drink a lot of beer, he says. But beer is now a precious commodity. Last week, the governor of Tabasco banned alcohol sales overnight, announcing the new rule from his home where he's quarantined. because he has the coronavirus.
Yo fui a Samsis y vi que la gente salía con carros llenos de cajas de vino, de cerveza.
Escamilla immediately went to the store to stock up. He said people's shopping carts were filled with boxes of wine and beer. There isn't a nationwide ban on the sale of alcohol in Mexico. It's still legal in Mexico City. But in other cities across the country, local officials have restricted the sale of it to halt the spread of the coronavirus. The bans include tourist hotspots like Los Cabos and Cancun. In the state of Nuevo León, the governor has suspended beer production, saying it's not an essential service. Corona, Pacifico, and Victoria are all produced there.
Si no va a haber distribución, pues que no haya venta, punto.
If there's not going to be distribution, we shouldn't have alcohol sales, Governor Jaime Calderon said at a press conference, which then set off panic buying of beer. There's a long history of restricting alcohol in Mexico.
All the way back even to the Aztecs.
That's Gretchen Pierce, a historian who has written about alcohol prohibition in Mexico. The Aztecs drank pulque, a fermented beverage made of agave. It was sacred.
Only certain groups were allowed to drink it. So, for example, the elderly, lactating women, warriors, groups like this.
And these prohibitions continued long after the Aztecs disappeared. During the Mexican Revolution in the early 20th century, alcohol was prohibited because it was believed to reduce productivity among workers, she says. When it comes to today's ban, the evidence between drinking and the coronavirus is still being studied, says George Koob, director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism at the National Institutes of Health.
What we know is that heavy drinking can worsen the impact of infections on the lungs because alcohol impairs the immune system.
And there are societal reasons to limit alcohol consumption. Dr. Francisco Moreno works at ABC Hospital in Mexico City.
The alcohol restrictions are more related to the psychological situation of isolation. There's evidence that isolation will depress people, and depression is associated with drugs and alcohol. And in Mexico, we have a lot of violence in the family setting.
In other words, alcohol can fuel domestic violence, especially when people are cooped up inside. And it's a problem in other countries, too. In Greenland, a health minister cited domestic violence as one of the reasons for banning alcohol sales until mid-April. South Africa also banned alcohol for 3 weeks, as well as cigarettes. It's for people's own good, says Adela Maker-Didix. She's with the Southern African Alcohol Policy Alliance.
Food security is going to become a big issue. And if we have people spending the little resource that they have currently on alcohol, the bigger issue is going to be hunger.
Maker Didix also argues that banning alcohol will lessen violence generally, which means fewer people going to the emergency room for that reason and taking up hospital beds for coronavirus patients. But critics say the alcohol ban is counterproductive and even dangerous. There are reports of people making their own alcohol at home. And some people, they're just annoyed by it. Like Carrie Kapka, a lawyer who lives in Cape Town.
It's kind of paternalistic attitude that they have towards our people and saying that, you know, you don't know what's right for you, so we're going to tell you.
Kapka is not much of a drinker. That is, until the coronavirus crisis hit.
I have been having one or two drinks. It helps, for whatever reason, kind of calm the nerves.
For now, Kapka has a healthy stash of alcohol at home. Maybe she'll sell it on the black market, she jokes. But black markets, they're actually happening. Back in Tabasco, Mexico, Jose Escamilla says he's not too worried about the ban.
La gente que quiera tomar va a conseguir. Seguramente va a conseguir. Más caro, pero va a conseguir.
People who want to drink are going to get their hands on it, he says. It will be more expensive, but they'll find a way. For The World, I'm Emily Green.
Generally, the faster governments respond to the pandemic, the better the result. But what about when activists jump in first? In Senegal, the conscious hip-hop movement Yanamar, that translates to We're Fed Up, they released a music video instructing people how to protect themselves from the outbreak. It's called Shield Against Coronavirus. Malal Al-Mamitala, also known as Fou Malade, is a rapper and one of the co-founders of Yanamar. He spoke to us from his home in Dakar.
We live in a very complicated country where a lot of Senegalese
in the beginning of coronavirus, they didn't believe that this disease is a reality. That's why, as loudspeakers, we have to make them understand and to involve them in the fight. Because Senegal is a very poor country. Our government doesn't have a lot of means to face this kind of disease.
Malal, in your video, you're all dressed in masks, gloves, and protective gear, you and the other members of Yanamar. You're actually filming in a hospital. It's a surprise that you got permission from the health ministry to do that. Is Yanamar really influential in Senegal?
Yes, because when we heard about coronavirus, the first thing we did, we went to meet the Ministry of Health just to say, we are ready to help you. We are here. We got some efforts. We want to be with you in the fight.
So I want you to give us your verse in the song Shield Against Coronavirus. Can you rap through it for us?
Le metina adunam no Senegal duguna ci gox yi am nañu mu dal nañu moy tu sa tete setal question de santé nationale. You hear me?
I hear you loud and clear. Wolof is a fantastic language to rap in. What are you saying?
I am saying that the coronavirus is now in the country. Now, the virus is being spread in all of the localities of the country. Please, we have to be clean. It is a question of national health.
Malal Almami Tala, also known as Fou Malade, he's a rapper and one of the co-founders of the hip-hop journalist collective Yanamar in Senegal. He's been speaking with me from Dakar. Malal, thank you very much. Merci.
Merci bien. Thank you so much.
The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe out there.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.